Years ago, the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, which is the conservative seminary in New York, wrote a paper. The thesis of the paper was that the Baal Tshuva movement is a cult, and in particular, it is anti-intellectual. It discourages people from thinking, from analyzing, discourages independence. Of course, the point of the article was to explain why it is that the Baal Tshuva movement is doing so well at attracting new people, and the conservative movement is doing so poorly at attracting new people. The answer is, Baal Tshuva movement's a cult, so, you know, we know the cults are flourishing everywhere. So as part of our ongoing effort to demolish this myth, I'm going to try to stimulate your brains a little bit this evening to get you to think. And then at the end I'll tell you what the point of it all is. Imagine the following case. A man gives woman, again, gives his wife a get. We all know what a get is, right? Who am I talking to here? A bill of divorce. He says to her, I'm giving you this get on condition. This is not free and clear. There's a condition attached. And the condition is that you should not be married to anyone for 30 days. After that, you can do as you please. But the get is given, the gerushin, the divorce, is conditional on your not being married to anyone for 30 days. Now, if it works at all, it works right away. The divorce is immediate, if it works at all. If something blows it up, it blows up. But if it works at all, it works right away. He's not delaying the divorce. He's just saying, we're divorced as of now. But there's a condition. Don't be married to anybody for 30 days. Well, on day 15, she and another Jewish man, in the presence of two witnesses who are not related to any of them, he says to her, will you be my wife? And she says, yes, I will. And he hands her a ring and says, hurry up, Israel. He says it slowly, with meaning and intention and experience. And she takes the ring. Now, here's the question. What is the situation now? Is she married to the first guy? Is she married to the second guy? What is the situation now? Okay, here she's married to the first guy, but the person says no, but was the person no, no, yeah? So she's married, so what is her condition now?
She's not married to anyone.
Okay, I hear married to the first guy, you say you're not married to anyone, but not married to anyone, okay, any other opinions? Before we go to the reasoning, let's hear. You say she's married to the first guy, you two say she's married to no one. Any other thoughts here? There's a possibility she's married to the same guy, but I don't even know that I want to say that. Okay, let's look at it. You say she's married to the first guy. Why?
Because in the divorce, it states that she can. That the divorce is good as long as she doesn't marry anybody within 30 days. Which means if she breaks the contract, then the get is meaningless and they're still married.
You hear what he says? There was a condition attached. Don't be married to anybody for 30 days. And she had this interaction with the second guy. So he says that breaks the condition. It breaks the condition, it breaks the contract, which means it was never a divorce. It was never a divorce, and she's married, still married to the first guy. That's what he says. Are you giving in now? Oh, he's giving in already. But you're not giving in. Why not?
Because marriage, getting a get, is supposed to be unchanging yourself from a marriage. So right. Once you've done that, even if the reasons, the condition of which haven't been met, you're still unchanged. You're still half of that marriage. So you can't suddenly go back into it just because the conditions for it weren't right. You've still got that gap to get out of it.
What do you say?
A contract is a contract. If you break the contract that's in hand, then it's as if the contract never existed, and it's as if they're still married.
He's not saying that she gets back into the marriage. He's saying she never got out of the marriage. Because, turn off the phone, Scott. He's saying she never got out of the marriage because, after all, the divorce was on a condition, and the condition wasn't met. If the condition wasn't met, there never was a divorce.
Well, the divorce was supposed to be given only on the 30th day, no?
No, it was given right away, but on condition. On condition that for 30 days something doesn't happen. Now, if you don't fulfill the condition, then usually with a contract, when which there's a condition, if you don't fulfill the condition, the original contract is null and void. Here the contract is the divorce. So he says she's still married to the first guy.
Saying that, I'm going to give you a divorce. So we're not married, we can't have relations, everything's off, but tonight that I'm giving you the divorce in the first place is that you don't marry anybody for 30 days.
Right.
So the fact that she's divorced from him, but it still doesn't make the second marriage a good Kenyan.
Well, he says she's married to the first guy.
But she's not married, he's divorced. They are divorced.
Listen to what he says. Let me give you a parallel that's simpler. He says, I give you a divorce on condition that it doesn't rain for 30 days. Stop. The guy's a jerk. That's his condition, right? Condition that shouldn't rain for 30 days. It rains on day 15. What happens now?
It's off.
It's off. You made a condition. The condition wasn't fulfilled. So the garrison is null and void. Nothing happened. He's still married to the first guy, right?
Yeah.
No, so he says it's the same thing here. Exactly the same thing here. Everybody with me? Mm-hmm. But the answer is wrong. The answer is wrong.
Good try,
definitely good try. It's the first step forward. We've got a few steps yet to go. Why is it... Why is the answer wrong? Let's think it through. He says there was a condition. And she broke the condition, and therefore she's still married to the first guy. If she's still married to the first guy, that means she's always been married to the first guy, according to your description, right? There was a piece of paper and a transaction, a witness, but that was irrelevant. That didn't work. You know, it's as if it never happened. So what exactly happened on day 15? On day 15, she and the second guy had a little interaction, right? They had two witnesses and a band, and they served food, right? And he gave her a ring. To whom did this fellow give a ring? To a woman who is? Again, let's start again. The picture we have here that he told us is, the garrison is no good. The garrison is no good. The get is no good. She's still married to the first guy. Which means she has always been married to the first guy. Since they got married 25 years ago, until this present moment, she has always been married to the first guy. So on day 15, when the second guy gave her a ring, the second guy is giving a ring to a married woman. What happens if a man gives a ring to a married woman? What happens?
Uh-oh.
Nothing happens. Giving a ring. Don't let your imagination run away with you. What happens if a man gives a ring to a married woman? Do they get married? A woman can't be married to two men.
It's not a legal marriage. Right?
It's nothing. It's a joke. It's charades.
But she wasn't married.
One second. What was the condition? She doesn't marry anyone for 30 days. The condition was not, don't pretend to marry somebody, don't play charades, you know, make a Purim play. The condition was, don't get married to anybody for 30 days. Did she break that condition? Doesn't sound like it. Now we're getting into a pickle. Yeah.
The logic kind of slip there. She's not married to begin with, and you're saying she's not married to begin with, and therefore her marriage is a good marriage, and therefore so it seems like it's good.
Wait. If she's not married to begin with, let's get this straight.
If the divorce was not a good divorce, so she isn't married, right?
Divorce is not a good divorce, then.
You're saying the divorce is not a good divorce.
I'm not saying anything. I was following out the consequences of his statement. His statement was she's still married to the first guy, right? I'm pointing out that you could run into trouble with that assumption. Let's run through what I said again. He said, I'm putting it all on him, see, it's not me. I'm just calculating the consequences. He says he's still married to the first guy. Now let's run down the track. Still married to the first guy means the get was no get. The gerushin, the divorce was no divorce. Nothing happened. Blew up. Disintegrated. So on day 15, when she took the ring from the second guy, that was a joke. It was a joke. She didn't marry the second guy. It was just a joke. The condition was not, don't make jokes. The condition was, don't be married to a second guy. So she didn't really break the condition. Now, one step further. If she really didn't break the condition, then?
She really broke the condition. She's divorced. And she's in another
15 days. No, the divorce is immediate. It happens, it's all, it's immediate, right?
Right.
So then the divorce is? Good.
It's only when the divorce is.
Wow, look where we've come to. We started with the assumption divorce was no good, and now we've arrived at the conclusion divorce is good. Are we getting into trouble?
Yeah.
So, my question would be, is the divorce immediate?
Yes, yes. If it works at all, it's immediate.
So the divorce, as soon as he gives it to her, she's divorced from him.
If it works at all.
Yeah. But, so, therefore, that means she was divorced, because she was divorced until she got married to the other guy.
No, if it works at all. Let's go back to the simple case. Let's talk about ring. Let's talk about ring, right? He gives her the divorce and he says, on condition that it should be dry for 30 days.
Then she's not divorced for 30 days.
No, it means I don't know yet whether she's divorced immediately or not. Watch. Let's say on day 2, she has relations with another man. Is it adultery or isn't it adultery? We don't know. Let's wait the month out. Now on day 15, when it rains, I now know that the gerushin on day 1 was no good. And therefore, she was still married to the guy. And therefore, on day 2, it was adultery. Whereas, if the month goes by dry, then I know the gerushin on day 1 was good, so she was divorced and it wasn't adultery. The divorce, if it takes place at all, takes place immediately. But it might not happen. It depends upon whether the condition is fulfilled. Okay? So again, if we start by saying that she's married to the first guy, it means the get was no good. If the get was no good on day 15, she was married to the first guy. Married to the first guy when she took a ring from the second guy, it was nothing. It was play acting. It was a joke. Which means she didn't break the condition. She fulfilled the condition. If she fulfilled the condition, then the get is good, and she's not married to the first guy. So, starting from the assumption that she is married to the first guy, we get to the conclusion that she is not married to the first guy. Now, that's not necessarily a disaster. When you will learn logic someday, when you grow up, you'll discover that if you can start with A and deduce not A, always conclude that A is false. That's not a contradiction. You just conclude that A is false. But now, let's run the circle around the other way from not A. So, the get really was good. That's where we are. The gerushin really was good, and she's not married to the first guy. Aha. So the gerushin really was good, and she's not married to the first guy. So what happened on day 15? When she took the ring from the second guy, we're saying she's not married to the first guy now. The gerushin was good. She was dissolved 15 days before. So that means on day 15, she's free and clear. So when she takes the ring from the second guy, wedding bells. She's really getting married. Again, if we say the get was good, and we say that she's not married to the first guy, it was severed on day 1. Goodbye. He goes to Los Angeles and she comes to Yerushalayim. They're gone. Disconnected. That's what we're saying now, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so now what happens on day 15?
But my question is, I thought that there's still the 30-day...
Either you say it's good or you don't say it's good. You make up your mind. You started by saying it's no good. We deduced that it is good. Now let's try out the consequences that it's good. Right? If you say it's good, that's we're coming to you as a judge 6 months later. What do you say? The get was good, they were divorced. That's my final ruling. You say, okay, very good. So you're telling me the get was good and the divorce took place on day 1. And the marriage was severed on day 1. So then, let's see what happened on day 15. Okay. On day 15, when she took the ring from the second guy, then it's a real marriage. According to you, when you say that they were really severed on day 1, then you are saying that on day 15, it was a real marriage. So you are saying that she really broke the condition of the get. Which means that you are really saying that the gerushin was no good and she's married to the first guy. In other words, if you say she's married to the first guy, we deduce that she's not married to the first guy. And if you say she's not married to the first guy, we deduce that she is married to the first guy. And that's not good. Because now you have a full paradox. Whatever you say, you can deduce the opposite. From A, you deduce not A. From not A, you deduce A. You have an absolute steer here. This is brought in the Rishonim. The steer is brought in the Rishonim. What do you do? Can you guess? What do you do practically in such a case? And then? No, not at all. It's a perfectly good condition. Any condition. After all, she could easily have fulfilled it, could she not? Wait till day 31 to take the ring. There's nothing inherently paradoxical in the condition. It's very easy to fulfill. It's only if she's impatient that she gets into trouble. She should take the Tylenol, right? And a little Valium and wait until the end of the 30 days. What's that a hurry for? Because otherwise we wouldn't have logic problems. That's why. The answer is she has to get a gift from both of them. And then she can start over. Although the problem, Maxim, will show somebody. Okay, fine. That's that case. You understand me? Now, I'll tell you another one, which is very similar, which comes from Menachas Chinuch about 200 years ago. You know how we do the new months. When we had the Sanhedrin, witnesses came and they said they saw the new moon, and the Sanhedrin would drill them to see whether they really saw it, where it was, and what shape it was. And if they passed the test, then they, on the basis of their testimony, they would declare it's a new moon. Now, two witnesses come to court and give any testimony you like. Two witnesses, for us, are credible. If two witnesses say something happened, we take action, including killing people. We take two witnesses very seriously. Suppose two witnesses say A happened. If two other witnesses come along and say it didn't happen, then I'm strung up. They say it did, and they say it didn't. I have a contradiction. I don't know who to believe, and I'm stuck. But there is a way for the second witnesses to win over the first witnesses. If the second witnesses say to the first witnesses, we don't know whether what you said is true or false, to tell you the truth, because we weren't there. So we can't pass judgment whether the thing happened or it didn't. But you weren't there either. Because you were with us someplace else. So when you give testimony, you're lying because you weren't there to see it. Maybe it happens. We don't know. The two first witnesses say we saw a murder in Madison Square Garden in New York. The second witnesses say, how can you say that? You were with us in Los Angeles at the same time. You weren't in Madison Square Garden in New York. You weren't anywhere near New York. So you're lying, even though the murder might have taken place. We don't know about that. We were in Los Angeles, and so were you in Los Angeles. And therefore, you cannot say what you said. The Torah tells us, believe the second witnesses, throw out the first witnesses, punish the first witnesses. Even though why we should do that is not exactly obvious. We'll talk about that in a few minutes in the session. But in the meantime, that's what the Torah tells us to do. If the second witnesses say to the first ones, you were with us someplace else, we believe the second ones and throw out the first ones. Okay, now here's what happens. Two witnesses come to the court, 11 a.m., and they say, last night we saw the new moon. And it was over the hill there. It was a little crest, and it came down a half hour before sunset. We saw it go down. Terrific. So the court is ready to declare the new moon. Two new witnesses come and say, how could you tell the court that you saw the new moon? Why, we were indoors playing poker all afternoon and evening. All four of us. You didn't look outside. There were no windows there. Maybe there was a new moon, the second one said. We weren't outside either. But you weren't outside. So you can't say you saw it. You certainly didn't see it. You were inside with us. What does the Torah tell us to do? Throw out the first witnesses. There's only one little odd fact here. When you look at the second witnesses, they look awfully young. Mere lads. So we on the court become interested and ask them, how old are you? Yeah, fellas, how old are you? I said, well, you know, until very, very recently, we had been 12 years old. I said, 12 years old? 12 years old is a minor. You can't give testimony in court. You're not an adult. Yeah, 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 but our birthday is right away. So, well, when is it exactly? Well, our birthday is on the first day of the next month. It's on Rosh Chodesh. Ha! What should the court do now? Accept the first witnesses, reject the first witnesses, accept the second witnesses, reject the second witnesses. What should the court do now? Can you smell the problem coming around the corner? Can you imagine that whatever you say, you're going to be in trouble? Let's try. If we accept the first witnesses, then what?
Then the lads are adults.
Then the lads are adults. And the lads told us that?
They weren't there in the first place.
The first witnesses were indoors. So they couldn't see the moon. So in which case we have to throw out the first witnesses. See, if I say I should accept the first witnesses, I end up throwing them out. That's already halfway around the corner, right? But I said, that's not so terrible. If A implies not A, you can just declare not A and throw them out. But now, if I throw out the first witnesses, then I don't know that it's the new moon. And if it's not the new moon, then the second witnesses are children. They're minors. And if they're minors, then I can't accept their testimony, which means there's no reason to throw out the first witnesses. So, what do you do? This was brought up by a rabbi. Didn't need a Greek to think of the paradoxes. The Michas Chinuch, the Mitzvah Dalet, you can look it up in Kiddushah Chodesh. Now, over there, there's a loophole. There are actually two things the court can do. The court can simply disqualify itself. It doesn't have to pass judgment at all. Accept or reject. You can simply say, we're just dismissing the case. The court also has the prerogative, if it so desires, to declare the new month even without testimony. They have that prerogative. So there are ways out, practically. But the circle of logic is exactly the same circle of logic. Now, let's talk about Eden Zomim. This case where the second one say you were with us and couldn't have seen it, and therefore you're lying because you weren't present. What's the thing supposed to have happened? And the Torah says to believe the second witnesses. Let's think in terms of logic. Is there any reason to believe the second witnesses?
No.
Do I have any reason to think? After all, let me put it this way. Do we know who's lying here? Somebody's lying here. Maybe it's the second witnesses who are lying. They say that they were indoors. Maybe they're just lying. Maybe they really were outdoors and did see the moon. Do I on the court know which witnesses are lying? Certainly do not. So is there any logic in telling me to trust the second witnesses and accept them and punish the first ones? We might even kill the first ones if it's a capital case. And the first one said that the accused was guilty of a capital crime. If the second one say you were with us someplace else, we'll kill the first witnesses. This is serious business here. And it's not obvious whether there's any logic to trusting the second witnesses. Now, I want you to know in the Gemara, there's a difference of opinion about this. One says there is logic and one says there is not. And there can be practical differences as well. So, the job that we have is this. For the one who says logic, we have to figure out what the logic might be. But we better not do too good a job. The logic better not be too perfect, because if the logic for the one who says it is logical is too perfect, then we'll never understand the other one who says it is illogical. So it's got to be logic, but the kind of logic you could take issue with if you looked at it differently. That's the job of the interpreter. And the fact is that this has been done. The tour supplies the logic of the one who says it's logical, and Shai Shapiro Hirsch supplies the reply, which is possible to make, but not necessary to make. Now let's try the two. What kind of logic could there be here? Let me move to a different case, and then I'll move back. Two witnesses come and say, Reuven and Shimon together killed Levi. We saw Reuven and Shimon together kill Levi. So they haul in Reuven and Levi, and Reuven and Levi say, no, we didn't. We didn't do it. It's not true. They're lying. Should we say it's two against two? These two say they did it, and they say they didn't do it. It's two against two. Well, how do I know who's lying? I should let them go free. Is that what you do in a court of law? Any court of law? In any legal system? Of course not. Because no one can be a witness for himself. No one can be a witness for himself. The person who's on trial himself isn't a witness. He's just trying to get out. See, even if there are two on trial for the same crime, because they cooperated, you don't say it's two against two. It's two against zero. No one can be a witness for himself. He can only have witnesses for other people. Okay? Now let's go through the logic here. The first witnesses come in and say, we saw the murder in Madison Square Garden. The second witnesses say to them, how could you say such a thing? You were with us in Los Angeles. How could you possibly give such a lying testimony to say that you saw it in New York when you were with us in Los Angeles? And now the first two say back, oh no, we weren't in Los Angeles, we were in New York. Who are they talking about now?
Themselves.
They're talking about themselves. They're talking about themselves. They're defending themselves against the crime of having lied at testimony. We don't let people talk about themselves. We don't let a person be a witness for himself. So when the first one say to the second, we were in New York, why are you saying we're Los Angeles? We were in New York. We rule that out of court. You can't be a witness for yourself. You're now accused of lying in court. You are the accused. You're the. What does it say? So now, when the second ones say that the first one's in the wrong place, nobody's contradicting them. True, I don't know who's the liar here and who's telling the truth. I don't know that. But the fact is, in any court of law, when witnesses say that something happened, you don't know that what they say is true. Any witness could be mistaken, any witness could be lying. In a court of law, you have rules of law. You have witnesses who say something, then the law says, carry it out. See, the second witness to say the first ones were in Los Angeles. Do I have anybody contradicting the fact that they were in Los Angeles? The first ones? I don't listen to them. The case has shifted now. The case is not a case of murder now. The case is now a case of lying in court. So the first witnesses are now defendants. A defendant isn't a witness in his own case. So the second one say the first one was in Los Angeles. All I have now is two witnesses saying that these guys were in Los Angeles. So now I know that. You know, I'm on the basis of law, when two witnesses tell me something, I use that as a fact. And I say to the first ones, listen, the second one say you're Los Angeles. There are two witnesses saying you're Los Angeles. So from the court's point of view, you're Los Angeles. And if you're Los Angeles, then you cannot tell me what happened in New York. Bang. That, says the tour, is the logic over here. Yes, I don't know who's telling the truth, but law tells me how to act, even when I don't know who's telling the truth. The fact is, in court, you never know who's telling the truth. Never. That doesn't stop all legal proceedings just because you don't know who's telling the truth. The law tells you what to do, even if you don't know who's telling the truth. Yeah.
And what if the first set of witnesses make a claim that those two guys were never where they were in the first place? That the first witnesses won with the second witnesses, or the second witnesses were never with them. Then where does that leave you?
Well, as far as I understand it, you do one case at a time. You don't mix cases. In other words, if A comes in with a claim against B, and B says, I have a claim against A also, you don't try both claims together.
So it's whoever gives the claim first?
In a way. I mean, here it'll be obvious, right? They're only answering back because the other ones came in. So it's also like lying, but it's pretty obvious they're doing it just to get out of it.
Well, I mean, they're doing it for one or two reasons. Either they're trying to get out of it, or they're really telling the truth and trying to tell these guys that they're really lying.
Well, but that can happen in any case. If two people come in and say that A violated Shabbos, or beat his wife, and he says, no, it's not true, and those guys are invalid because they violated Shabbos also. You don't know who's telling the truth. But there's a difference between a witness and a defendant on the one hand, and when the defendant turns around and wants to be a witness against the other ones, we say, I'm sorry. Finishing this case first, and then you can do something with respect to them, it's another matter, but you can't defend yourself that way.
Yeah, but in a case where you're saying it's not a disgrace Shabbos, if you come to a conclusion where first set of witnesses were not kosher witnesses, then you would have to put them to death, right? That'd be or any case where you just put somebody to death, how can they defend themselves against somebody else when they have a claim against
No defendant has the authority to defend himself. No, if you allow a defendant to defend himself, you'll never convict anybody.
No. What I'm saying is if the first set of witnesses say, no, you weren't there, you were somewhere else.
Yes.
If the first set of witnesses have been tried and convicted, and now they face the death penalty, do they have a chance to go to court against the second set of
No, because if they've committed that kind of crime, then they're not credible as witnesses at all. But you understand, if you do it any other way, you'll never convict anybody of anything. Because the defendant will always say, no, you weren't there, you were someplace else, and you can't convict anybody of anything. There has to be an order of procedure, otherwise you can always stop every crime.
What if the first witnesses say that they were in New York, they saw the murder, second witnesses say, no, you were with us in Los Angeles, the first witnesses come back and say, no, you were with us in New York.
Yeah, but you understand, when the second witnesses say the first were in Los Angeles, we have a new case now. The case is, have the first witnesses lied in court or not? Okay, so they are now defendants. Defendants have no credibility in their own case.
They can't turn back into witnesses, right?
Not in their own case. They may turn into witnesses in some other case, assuming that they're not convicted. Mm-hmm. Right, or even they're convicted of a minor crime. But to defend themselves in their own case, they can't become witnesses. Otherwise, you'll never convict anybody. So when the second witnesses come in, they are accusing the first witnesses of a crime.
Yeah.
So the first witnesses are now the defendants.
Right, but now he says that the people in New York stated that the people in Los Angeles were with them in New York.
We don't listen to them because they are now defendants.
No, but now the people from Los Angeles are defending.
No, we haven't finished. No. We haven't finished this case yet, right? The second witnesses say the first ones have lied in court because they were in Los Angeles. So the first witnesses are now the defendants. Right? Now let's finish that case. Do we have any other testimony on the subject? Do we have any other witnesses on the subject? I can't let the defendants become counter witnesses in their own case, because if I do that, you'll never convict anybody of anything.
Can the other witnesses
either? Sure, they certainly can.
Well, two witnesses can say that, you know, he was in New York. They could say that you said you know, Los Angeles with them, you were with us. They can only say none of you said. They can't argue with witnesses.
A new set of witnesses can come, a third set can come, say the second set, you were with us in Ottawa. So how can you say they were in Los Angeles?
They can't say that you and Sim were in New York.
Well, they can say it, and they'll contradict them, and then they'll stymie the case. Then the first ones will not be punished. Sure they can. Then you have Akasha and the Azama. Right. No, that's not a problem either. Anyway, so that's the tourist argument. No, sounds pretty good. Now, how could it be that the other one in the Gemara says no? He says, no, it's not logical. So this, the Council for Hirsch analyzes. He analyzes as follows. The first one say there was a murder in New York. The second one say, how could you do that? How could you do that? You are a liar because you're with us in Los Angeles. Let me take another slight change in the case for comparison, and then I'll come back. Suppose the second witnesses say, how could you give testimony about the murder of New York when you yourselves are the brothers of the dead guy? You know witnesses can't give testimony. Now suppose the first two witnesses say, no, we're not brothers of the dead guy. So don't be stupid, right? There are two witnesses saying you are. You can't say back you're not. You're not defendants. Suppose the second two witnesses say, how could you give testimony in such a case when you yourselves are convicted liars? You lied 3 months ago in another court. Your testimony is invalid. And the first witnesses say, no, we didn't lie. We're not going to listen to them. I have two witnesses saying that they were convicted in court. They can't defend themselves and say, no, I wasn't. Suppose the second witnesses say to the first ones, how could you give testimony that there was a murder in New York when just today you became 13? So when you saw it in New York, you were minors.
Exactly.
And therefore you're not qualified as witnesses. Yes, you have to be an adult when the event takes place. Can the first two witnesses say, oh no, we were 13 2 weeks ago? No, because they're defending themselves. In all these cases, says the founder of Hirsch, It's clear that the Torah is right. The Torah is clearly right in these cases. Because the attack of the second witnesses on the first has nothing to do with the details of the case. The second witnesses in all these cases are coming from outside. Your relatives, your minors, your convicted of some other crime, they're coming from the outside. But in this case, the second witnesses are saying, you were with us in Los Angeles. What did the first witnesses say? The first witnesses said, we saw a murder in New York. If the case stopped there, nobody else came in, would you believe them? Yes. Well, isn't it included? Isn't it included? When they say, we saw the murder in New York, isn't it included that they were in New York? Mm-hmm. I mean, if they weren't in New York, then they couldn't very well have seen it in New York. Okay, they didn't say they were in New York, but certainly included. It's certainly part of the content of what they're saying. And you would have believed it. You would have treated them as witnesses. You would have given them credibility. You're talking about themselves. True, but in this case, every time you give testimony, I saw something happen that's such and such a place, it's included in the testimony that you were in that place at that time. So, although usually we don't believe a person when he's talking about himself, usually, if he says I'm such and such an age, if he says I never was convicted of a crime, if he says I'm not the guy's brother, I don't believe him. But if he says I was there at the time and place of the event that I gave my testimony on, there, since it's Shach Bill Hirsch, you might give him credibility. You might treat him as a witness in his own case, a witness around his own position. Because it's included in his original testimony, which you would have believed, given full credibility to, and used to punish the criminal. So here's the difference of opinion. A fact which is not in the testimony of the first witnesses, but is included as part of the story, although they didn't say it, do you give the credibility of testimony to that included fact or not? The one who says there's logic in Adam Zolomon, in the fact that you believe the second witnesses, says you don't give any credibility to the included fact. Since you don't give any credibility to it, they're talking about themselves, throw it out. If you throw it out, then of course you take the statement of the second witnesses. The one who says that you do give credibility to the included fact, so they have the credibility of witnesses. Now it's two against two. Two against two, you don't know who you should trust, who you should accept. And then the Torah tells you without logic, accept the second one. This is the difference of opinion. Whether you give the credibility of testimony to a fact which wasn't said, but was implied as part of the original testimony. That's the difference of opinion. And here's the difference of opinion you could hear. You could sort of understand how it could be two opinions about this. You have a question?
Yeah, well, a while ago when he said that if they say, okay, you turned 13 yesterday, because the witnesses say, but what if they really turned 13 2 weeks ago? In other words, what if they're wrong?
But you see,
you can defend yourself, but it's a fact.
All testimonies about facts. When they say A killed B in Madison Square Garden, it's either a fact or it isn't, right?
If they say you turned 13 yesterday,
yes.
That's not true. So even if
they're... Well, if a murder happened, it happened. If it didn't happen, it didn't. All facts are like that. That's no different from any other fact.
But in that case, the other two, the ones that are defending themselves,
yes.
I think they could easily say, look, you're wrong, because we didn't turn 13 yesterday. Probably.
But they might be lying, might they not? That's something else. We're talking now about what you do in terms of testimony. If it's possible to prove it, that's something else. But there are many times and places in history where it was not possible to prove these things.
Your birth?
Think your birth certificates? Think about Poland 100 years ago. Okay. You know, there are people who came from Europe and you asked them how old they are? They don't know how old they are. They themselves don't know how old they are. Because records weren't kept and there were a lot of kids and parents died and, it's easy enough to think of cases like that where, records are destroyed, there's a revolution and everything's burned and kids are taken over by different parents and treated badly. It's not too hard to understand that such a thing could happen. Yeah.
Yeah, I know with facts where some old person from Europe wanted to know their English birthdate and one bit of knowledge they had, their Hebrew birthdate. So what can I do with that?
Yeah, sometimes you can do it, but sometimes you can't. Okay. Now, did I have another one? Yes, one more. One more. This I don't know if I told this to some of you, but many have not heard this. If you have heard it, probably would be worthwhile to have a review. We believe that God is omnipotent. Omnipotent. That's usually understood to mean he can do anything. That's what people will tell you. People don't think too much. I mean, you know, that's what people will tell you. Okay. Now, can God make a stone so heavy that he cannot lift it? Can God make a stone too heavy for him to lift? Can you sense a problem here? Let's see. What should we say? Yeah, God can do anything, right? So surely he can make a stone too heavy for him to lift. So then, can he lift it? Is the stone too heavy for him to lift? Presumably not. So then that means there's something he can't do. Ah, you'll tell me he can't create it. So then there's something he can't do. Either way, you're stuck. Either way, you have to admit there's something he can't do. Either he can't create it, or if he can create it, he can't lift it. And either way, you're stuck. So, you're free to go out and get cheeseburgers, because obviously the idea of God is incoherent, you know, it's contradictory, and Judaism's down the drain. Well, Judaism doesn't go down the drain so fast. But it's a nice question. It's going to frustrate your Talmud teachers at home, you know, in yeshiva, asking this question to see what they do. But of course, make sure they get a contract and we'll throw you out. But aside from that, it's a nice question. So I'm going to give you a little background. God can do anything, huh? Is that what we think? Is that what we believe? God can do anything? Let me try some examples on you. Let me hear what you have to say. Can God learn something new?
No.
We can. We all can learn something new. So it means learning something new is a genuine ability. If we have it, it's got to be a genuine ability. And you are now all shaking your heads. No, God cannot do that. Gosh. 30 seconds ago. Everybody was saying God can do anything. And now all of a sudden you're just rolling over and playing dead. You know, here he is. Can't do that. How about God making a mistake?
Yeah, but Rabbi.
Okay, I know, but Rabbi. But Rabbi is not going to help you here. It's not going to help you here. What about, so what? That wasn't the question. The question was, can he do everything? What you're doing is giving me a reason to change my mind and say he can't do everything. But it's not saving the idea that he can do everything. I don't know, we're throwing that out. Can God improve? Improve? We can improve. Right? So it's a genuine ability. Nothing incoherent about the ability of improving. When it comes to God, you know, you don't want to say that. Right? So the truth is, obviously there's a whole category of things God cannot do for his reason. For the reason that he said. There are certain abilities that go together with weakness. There are certain, to give the right formulation, there are certain abilities that go together with imperfection. Certain abilities that only imperfect beings have. Obviously God doesn't have those abilities because God is perfect. When we said God could do anything, what we really should have said is, God could do anything that a perfect being can do. He lacks no abilities that a perfect being should have. But if a perfect being shouldn't have certain abilities, then of course shouldn't have those abilities. Because the bottom line is that he's perfect. The bottom line is not he can do everything. The bottom line is that he's perfect. And sometimes perfection means there's certain things you can't do. Yeah. Sometimes perfection means certain things you can't do. A tricky one, well, here's one that they agree on, but you might think about. Can God commit suicide? Can God commit suicide? So according to our views, according to our books, God's existence is necessary. Not an accident. That's something you can turn on and off. So God's part of God's perfection is that his existence is necessary. And if so, he can't commit suicide. Because the ability to commit suicide is a weakness. If you're able to commit suicide, it means you don't have to be. Your being is just an accident. And we could turn the accident off. So the strength in the ability to commit suicide is really a weakness. It means you could just as well not be here. God isn't like that. He's not weak in that way. The tricky question is, can God do evil? That's an interesting question. I'm just going to mention it to you to think about, something to think about on another occasion. Yeah, well, okay, I just said I'm leaving you to think about. I don't want to discuss it now. Can God do evil? But that, these is all one category. This is not, has nothing to do with the rock. We didn't get to the rock yet. Yeah.
And that's another thing about committing suicide. Like the Rambam says, God wills us to be here, so could God will himself out of existence, because that's not really a weakness as a flaw in your being, like committing suicide,
but
to will yourself out of existence.
That is suicide. That's what I meant by suicide. God wouldn't do it with a gun. And he wouldn't put a gun to his head and pull the trigger. He hasn't got a head, he doesn't have an eye. But the idea would be for him to will himself out of existence. That's only possible if his very existence is not necessary. And since his existence is not necessary, then his committing suicide is ruled out. Yeah.
This is also equally applicable to God. Can God contradict himself?
That's a little more tricky. If contradict yourself means say A today and say not A tomorrow, just say it, of course, that's no problem. Mean it? I don't know what that would mean for God. It's going to be hard to define exactly what we're talking about. Now, but that has nothing to do with the stone. That's just to break down your prejudices. Okay? And I hope they're now broken. Shattered. Lying in shards on the floor. Okay, now let's go to the other category.
Shattered, I'm a half hour delirious now.
Better you should learn here than elsewhere. Here you'll survive it and you won't go out and get cheeseburgers afterwards. Hopefully. Now, let's go to the other category. What should we say about the following cases? God has challenged me to a game of chess. But, of course, he's a much better player than I am. So he's given me an advantage. He's playing with only his king. I have all my pieces, and he's playing only with his king. Can God checkmate me? Now, listen, don't build in human limitations here. We're talking about God. Maybe God could do it. You know, I mean, it's hard for us. You know, how could, but it's hard. But can God divide two into five without remainder? Can God correctly spell the English word table with four letters? Here's another example. You know, in university, when you get an examination, there's often an examination booklet, which has several pages of questions. You have to answer the questions. Now imagine you get one of these booklets, and question one says, first step is, copy the paragraph on page 6. Right? You say, okay. You have your pencil, your paper, you know, or you can get on a computer. You start turning the pages, and you discover that the last page of the booklet is page 5. There is no page 6. At the bottom of page 5, it says end of exam. You know, go home, have a nice day. There is no page 6. Can God pass that exam? Something's wrong here. Something desperately wrong here. In Jewish sources, you have the question this way. Shall we say that God can make a square circle? Says the Rambam, no. Says the Malbim, no. And the others, I think, I don't remember, but others have said it, but I think everybody would agree to it. We don't say that. Why not? What's wrong here? This is not like making a mistake or improving or learning something new. This is much more drastic. If I contradict myself, if I contradict myself in describing what needs to be done, then I have not specified anything to be done. And if so, asking whether or not God can do it is an incompetent question because there's no it to ask about. I'll say that again. If I contradict myself in describing what needs to be done, then I have not succeeded in specifying a task to be done. And if I haven't succeeded in specifying a task to be done, then there's no point in asking, can God do it? Because there's no it. I'll give you a parallel, just to make this more intuitive. We have a painter, a portrait painter. This guy paints portraits. Now, portraits are very difficult to express the character of a person on a canvas. And he's super. The claim is he could paint anybody. All different races, all different nationalities. You know, the bone structure and the muscle structure is different. You have Oriental people, you have Eskimos, and you have black people and white people. You have all different kinds of people. And he can do everybody. So somebody asks, oh, he can paint everybody, right? Can he paint Santa Claus? A realistic picture, capturing the real character of Santa Claus. Yeah, don't be stupid, of course not. Whoa, wait a moment, so, see? Can't paint everybody. There's an exception. Can't paint Santa Claus. That's dumb, right? Because, I hope I'm not breaking your hearts, but there isn't any Santa Claus, right? There isn't any Santa Claus. So, when I say Santa Claus, I have not provided a candidate to be painted. There's no limitation if I say the painter can't paint Santa Claus, because there is no Santa Claus to paint. The failure there is not in the painter, the failure is in me. I didn't provide a subject to be painted. Subject meaning person, right? Person who sits there while you're painting. Similarly, if I contradict myself in describing what God is supposed to do, then I haven't provided something to be done. So asking, can he do it or not, is an absurd question. So if I say, can God make a square circle or not? The answer is, you haven't asked the question. I'm not going to say that he can, and I'm not going to say that he can't, because if I say he can or I say that he can't, then I'm pretending the question was a good question. I'm pretending to give you an answer. What I should really do is refuse the question. Not answer yes and not answer no, but refuse to answer on the grounds that you haven't provided a question. So I'm not going to say that he can, and I'm not going to say that he can't. I'm going to refuse to answer the question. Now, let's go back to the stone. This is the final step. Then I'll take 2 minutes to tell you why I did all this stuff. Let's go back to the stone. The question that was put was, can God create a stone too heavy for him to lift? That description, stone too heavy for God to lift, is just as bad as square circle. It's just as bad as the exam. It's just as bad as checkmate with only a king. It is an inherent contradiction. So when I say, or the questioner says, stone too heavy for God to lift, we're going to stop him right there. Is stone too heavy for God to lift? That's a contradiction. And since it's a contradiction, you have not described something to be done. So the question whether God can do it or not doesn't even arise. Because there's no it. Why is stone too heavy for God to lift a contradiction? Because, let's see what it means. Stone too heavy for God to lift. For God. No. Not your next door weightlifter, but God. But God is all powerful. So it means stone too heavy for God, who is all powerful, to lift. Which means stone so heavy that God, who could lift anything, can't lift it. Which means it's a stone so heavy that God can lift it and can't lift it. And that is a contradiction. A stone too heavy for God to lift means stone so heavy that the God who can lift it can't lift it. And that's a contradiction. So at that point I say to the person raising the question, you have failed to raise a question. Because you are contradicting yourself in describing the thing to be done. Mainly, you haven't provided anything to be done. You haven't provided anything to be done. There's no point in asking whether God can do it, because there is no it here. It's just as bad as Santa Claus. So now, in this category, we have a different response. When it was God learning something new or improving, then I said positively, he can't do those things. When it's a contradiction, I just don't say. I don't say he can't. I don't say that he can't. I refuse the question on the ground that the question does not describe anything coherent to be done. This, I think, gives a new insight into what we mean when we talk about omnipotence. And it shows you that when you talk about God, things can get tricky. And only if you use logic and intelligence are you going to be able to get some clarification as to what's going on. Now let me take 2 minutes to tell you why I did this tonight. Aside from that little mental stimulation, which isn't a bad idea in Yeshiva. Some people want to know why Jewish study is so hard, and it really is hard. It really is hard. Why does it have to be so hard? Even psukim, even verses in the Torah. If you don't pay attention, you don't get it. If you don't try, you don't get it. And sometimes you can think you've got it for years and years, and all of a sudden discover, oh, I forgot to take account of that. The subject came before the verb. Instead of the verb, what's the matter with me? If the subject comes before, it's an entirely different shot. Why is it so complicated? One reason is that you're supposed to serve God with all of your abilities, all of your talents, all of your strengths. And that includes your brain. Your brain has to be online when you're serving God. And that means not only experiencing consciously and thinking and focusing and having kavana, but it means analyzing, using all the logic that you're capable of. After all, you use logic to protect your health. You use logic to make money. You use logic to defend yourselves against attack. To use logic in all those areas of life and not to use logic in serving God would mean that a very important part of you is cut out of the service of God. Here, the Torah addresses every aspect of the person, including his intelligence. And there is endless, endless challenge for your intelligence so that your totally online in your service of God, and all of your capacities are involved, and there's no end to the development of all your capacities, even within just the life of living Torah. Now, there are questions about what we said?
Yeah.
Because Ralph knows that there are times that some go to, like that the Arnas and the Mimim, things like that. What does that mean?
Okay, of course, nobody else here knows what you're talking about. So, I mean, I've tried to tell people, you know, we're black camels, but when you ask a question, I take into account everybody else's. But anyway, there is a statement in the Talmud that if you measure the size of the Holy of Holies, and you measure the size of the Arum, and you measure the distance from the wall to the Arum, to the borders of the Holy of Holies, and then you find out that there's a contradiction in the measurements, and that if I take into account the size of the area of the space, then there's no room for the Aron at all. It's sort of like this. You know, imagine you have a box in the middle of a room, and you measure the wall of the room, and it's 40. And then you measure the distance from one wall of the box to the wall of the room is 20, and you measure the distance from the other wall of the box to the other wall is 20, and then there's no room left for the box. And the box measures 10. Now, actually, with Einstein in hand, you could do a little bit here. Is this statement in Chazal saying that the size of the room is 40, and the size, the space from the walls of the box to the walls of the room are 20 and 20, and the box is 10? Is that what they say? Or is Chazal saying, when you take a ruler and you measure the wall, you get 40. And when you take a ruler and you measure from the wall of the box to the wall, you get 20. And from this wall of the box to the wall of the box is 20. And when you measure the box, you also get 10. What are they saying? Are they saying what the sizes are? But they're saying, what happens when you measure? Well, of course, they didn't speak in those terms at all, so it's hard to know. And according to Einstein, and that means according to all of 20th century science, the size of a thing is what you get when you measure. That's all it is. There's no such thing as size independent of measure. That's how they can say ridiculous things like if something's whizzing past you, it gets shorter. It gets shorter because it's whizzing past you. And that means, for you, it could be 10 feet long, and for the guy inside the thing whizzing past you when he measures it's 20 feet long. That's okay. What is it really? Drop the word really. Drop the word really. You talk about what you measure when you measure it, and he talks about what he measures when he measures it. That's all. For you, it measures 10, for him, it measures 20. End of story. Ah, it's the same thing. How could it be? It is. That's the way the world is. Stop thinking about what it really is, and start thinking about what happens when I measure. No, if you can tolerate the very same thing, when I measure it, it's 10, when he measures it, 20, and not tell me that it's, and it's a thought contradiction, it's real. This is proven in experiment. So maybe, what Chazal says, it's been so terrible. What they're telling me is, when you measure this, you get this. When you measure that, you get that. When you measure that, you get that. Funny things happen in this environment where when you measure things, you get unusual results. But we're talking about physically carrying around rulers and measuring them. That's all. That's one way out. Other than that, I should say this. I went through this not too long ago. Other than that, what you should say is this. If Chazal are telling us that these are the real measurements, then we have to say we don't understand what Chazal is saying. They said these words and they're meaningless to us. Because since it's a contradiction, it is meaningless. Either they said it, they must have had a reason to say it. They must have meant something else. They must have meant something that I don't understand. But to me, they mean nothing because to me, they are just a blatant contradiction. If somebody says a blatant contradiction, to me, I'll give you, I thought of an example for this. You are sitting with Einstein, and he's giving a lecture in Germany in German. And you don't understand a word of German. But you know Einstein. Somebody comes up to you afterwards and says, do you think that what Einstein said in the lecture is true? What should you say? You say, well, you know, actually, I don't happen to speak or understand German, so I don't know what he said, but I know Einstein. And if Einstein said it, it's probably true, whatever it was. Right? I can say that about Chazal also. I don't know what they said, because the words that they wrote down are a contradiction. There must have meant something to them. I don't know what it meant to them. I can say it's true because they said it, whatever it is, but I can't affirm that the idea is true because I don't know what the idea is. The idea is just not in my head. All this still sticks with the principle that if you contradict yourself, then in those words you said nothing. Maybe you meant something, but to me it means nothing because to me all I've got is a contradiction. Okay?